Okay, thanks. If you just reflect a little bit, let's go back to the beginning of the course. And at the beginning, we started with something very basic, which is just the appreciation of being alive. The fact that we're alive is a wonderful thing. And we had to start with that basis. And the second day we moved into the difficulty of being alive. The fact that being alive is not a piece of cake. Life is brutal, nasty, and short, as one of the great biologists said. But we reflected on the issue of pain as a meeting with truth, and pain as not something that we should avoid or we should deny, because it destroys things if we do. And there's a reflection how much the denial of pain in the end leads to the destruction of the planet, of good things. Because as we try and repair and fix things and make our life better and avoid pain, so the forests are cut down and the people are hurt and wars and conflicts are happening. So expressing the denial of pain as something which we can heal by expressing the pain, by allowing it and seeing it not as a problem, but as a true experience of being alive. And then the next day, we explored more some of the roots of our possibility to change things, our possibility to see things from a larger vision. And today, I'd like to begin to put this larger vision into a more social context, to actually talk about it in relation to our relationship with each other and with the planet and with the society. So, the language of Dharma is a language that says we have a choice. And the choice is either we sleep through our life or we wake up. The Dharma, the spiritual teachings, do not tell us we have to believe in a set of beliefs. But they tell us that if we fall asleep through our life, then naturally things are going to be painful and difficult for us and for the planet. And what is the sleep? And the sleep is a sense of being locked into a suffering self. In an uncontrollable life that we are always battling and struggling against. That's the sleep. The sleep is being wrapped in ourself and our self-interest. What I need, what I want, what must be, what I want to be more comfortable. We can reflect on the early mythological story of the Buddha, where he was basically in a prison in a castle of comfort. And he, the myth says that he grew up and he lived in a castle in which everything was provided for him, and he was encouraged to be totally, every need and every want was supplied. And he got more and more frustrated with the situation and began to creep out and go outside and to see what was out there, where he met suffering, difficulty, death, and he met the possibility of liberation or freedom in the form of a practitioner, a spiritual person. But the point is that he was locked in a kind of comfort zone, which we have. We have our comfort zone, what we feel we want, what we need, what we don't want, what we like, what we want to be well, we want to be healthy, we don't want to be sick, we want to have money, we want to have possessions, we want to have love, we want to have life, we don't want to lose things, you know, we're all the time. We want to eat 3 times a day and drink 25 cups of tea. And if we don't get them, we suffer. And that's sleep. That's seen as a kind of a sleep. The three words that summarize it in the teachings are greed, hate, and delusion. And greed is the I want. I need. Magiya li. I deserve. It should be like this. And if we think about it, if we really buy in to this greed mind, the character of this mind is that the desire is endless. It can never be satisfied. If you remember the story of King Midas, the Greek legend, where he was so desperate for gold that he turned everything, he got his wish, that everything he touched turned to gold. And then his children came, and he touched them, and they turned into gold, and his family turned into gold, and the land turned into gold, and everything became dead and frozen and killed by his greed. And that's the nature of greed. It's endless. It's never fulfilled. The opposite of greed is negativity, hate. I don't want this. I don't want that. I don't want what makes me uncomfortable. I don't want what makes me threatened. I want to be secure. So I'm seeing everywhere enemies. I don't want this and I don't want that and I don't like him and I don't like her and I don't like that and I don't like this. And things should be different. And it's a mind, again, endless. And it's a kind of a sleep. If we buy into it, if we sell ourselves to this mind, we go into a sleep. We're busy all our life with it. Of trying to be, for example, secure. Just think of the people that have enough money for all their needs and they cannot stop because of insecurity accumulating and accumulating more and more and more until they die. And it's no, it doesn't help anybody. And so this kind of, running away from pain also leads to loneliness. It also leads to isolation. Running away from discomfort, from insecurity. And the third is delusion. Greed, hate, and delusion. The third is delusion. Delusion that all kinds, every kind. Delusion, for example, that there is no death. All of us have this delusion. It's very deep inside the psyche. That somehow or other we'll live forever. We don't really feel that death is happening all the time to us and to others. But it's happening in the moment. It's happening now. And millions of cells in our bodies are dying. And the moment we just had is dying and dead, and the two Dharma talks I gave yesterday are dead and gone from the tape, and everything is going, and that's okay. How can it be any other way? And living and dying is happening all the time, but the great thing, the busy thing, is with trying to deny it. And I don't know if you know the Mahabharata, there's this story from the king there, and he wanted to cross a river. And the god of the Nagas the river gods, the dragons of the river, that are symbols of wisdom. So he said, okay, you can cross the river if you answer three riddles. And then one was, what's the most extraordinary and amazing thing about human beings? And of course, being the king, very wise, he got it right. The amazing thing is that humans see death everywhere and think that they're not going to die. And so it's a kind of one example of one of the delusions that we have. And another delusion is that the world made us. We are in the world. And we talked a little bit about this. We're made of stars. We're made of carbon and nitrogen and oxygen. We're made of dust. And we think we're separate from the world. We think that the world is out there and we're in here. And the two are completely separate. And every second, every microsecond, all of us are being changed, and we're thoroughly disposable, and we get swallowed by the earth, and every minute we're all in interaction with the world, and all our cells are changing, and our breath is going in and out, and yet we think we're separate beings. And around this delusion is our walls that we build, and the walls we protect ourselves in. So greed, hate and delusion are the kind of sleep. But living in a society which is quite bought in to the myth of greed, hate and delusion. If we consider the modern world we live in, it seems to work on one level. It seems to work. We have food, we're not starving. But if we look a little bit under the surface, it really is built on greed, hate and delusion. The greed is so... it's so clear in everything that happens. There is a kind of desperation in the world, in the modern society, to have more, to have the extra, to have the newer, to have another car, to have, you know, to keep having. And this kind of view is exported all over the world, and societies that were running on a different basis, as soon as this touches them, this greed mind, this greed society, they get utterly devastated. I'm thinking here of a book written by Norbert Lodge on Ladakh. Helen? Yeah. And maybe some of you have read this book, but there are many books of this kind about the society in Ladakh, where they had a kind of ancient traditional balance in which the land and the people were in relationship. They had the animals, they had just enough animals, they were doing agriculture, they had enough food, there was rich society of tradition, and every wedding was celebrated with days and days of freedom and days of celebration, and there was lots of festivals, and then arrived the cow rather than the yak, right? Yeah, and arrived the cow, because people said, well, maybe you need more milk. So the cow ate more land, and at different levels of the land, it ate different ecology, began to eat more of the plants. There was the instability in ecology, but they had more milk, so they began to sell the milk, and then they had money, and then they needed more. They started to buy things. And slowly, no one had any time anymore. They were all much more busy. They didn't celebrate their weddings for 10 days because they were trying to get more money, so that they lost a lot of their tradition. They lost their time. They didn't have enough time anymore. The festivals weren't celebrated the same, etc., etc. So a kind of a society moved from a kind of balance to a kind of greed-oriented society. And if we think about the poverty in the world, it doesn't stop. In other words, all the illusion that the consumer culture is good for the world is actually going to pieces. There is more and more poverty than ever there was before, and more inequality than ever there was before. And the rich are just getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. We know all that. But this society is built around, it's legitimate to want more and more and more and more. It's like, it's okay. It's not seen as a distortion. Another example, I just finished a book, and the book is called The Promised Wasteland. And in Hebrew, Eretz Hamuz Nachat. And I do talk about in the book, here in Israel, we see this as the promised land, okay, Eretz Hamuftachat, a land promised to us. But actually, everybody feels that in the world. This is mine. This is promised to me. I paid money. I want this piece of land. I own this piece of land. I own more land. I own more. And this ownership is very destructive. And so in the book, I talk about this in relation to Israel. And it's a personal story. We'll talk a bit more about it in a minute. But just the sense that if you have a mindset of this land for me, you can't help destroy it. What happens is you cover it with concrete and you don't pay attention to what the land wants, what the land is actually telling you. You don't pay attention to the relationship with the land. You don't pay attention to the fact that you belong to the land. The land doesn't belong to you. Just because you've got a piece of paper in a tabu means it's yours. You belong to the land, not the land to you. And actually, the truth is, you both belong to each other. There isn't belonging here, it's just relationship. You belong to land, land belongs to you. Everything is promised to everything else. There's no such thing as the promised land promised to me. You can only destroy land that way. And you can see, the ecology in Israel is really in a very bad state because of this sense, it's ours, we can cover it with concrete, we can do what we like with it, we can play with it, we can smash the forests, we can, anything is, because it's ours. We want to show that we're here, and we own it, and we're succeeding, and this mindset is destroying the land. Relationship doesn't destroy the land, but ownership is illusion, delusion of ownership. Part of greed, hate, and delusion. Big delusion, delusion of ownership. Where is ownership? How can we own anything? How can we own anything at all? It's illusion. Where on the map, where on the globe is the thing that says Israel and it's owned? It's land, it's earth, it's other kinds of delusions, greed, hate, and delusion that are very strong in our society today is the illusion of growth, is the illusion of economic growth. That the one thing that shows that we're healthy is that the economy is growing. and means everyone's getting more. And that more, if things stop, there's disaster. And the more that is, and of course people feel happy if there's more. There's more things, more possessions, more economic growth, more, the richest countries in the world are the ones that are crying most about economic growth. If their growth slows down, they cry most. And they're the richest countries in the world. And there's a lot of sickness that comes out of this, and there's a lot of loneliness, and there's a lot of isolation in our society, and there's Mother Teresa once said, someone came to her and said, oh, India is such a sick place full of sicknesses. And she said, no, we have cholera and so on, but in the West you have sickness of loneliness, and it's much, much worse. So children grow up in this world, and children know it. And children grow up and they know the problems. They know this society based on greed, hate and delusion. If you think about the struggles children growing up in our world, the children understand. And they tell us, adults. And hopefully if we have a child mind, we'll understand. If our mind becomes more childlike, sort of innocent, we'll understand. But as adults, we need to go through some kind of a process, I think, to remember this, to keep remembering greed, hate and delusion, and to keep remembering another view. And this is in a way where the Dharma comes in, but not just the Dharma. This is not the territory of the Dharma. This is the territory of kind of waking up. And it doesn't need the Buddha, it doesn't need any particular path for this. It needs us to be serious about waking up and looking at the truth. And we need help sometimes to wake up. And here the Dharma can help us, but other things too. Our natural wisdom and our society. Forming a small society of people that say, we'll wake up together. And it can be a society of, you know, the rainbows. It can be a society of a retreat. It can be a society of what's happening here in this place, in your place here, Riyadh. But to talk, because this is, for these few days at least, the form of the teaching that we're giving, which is the Dharma teaching, and it's just for these few days, and as I say, there's many forms of teaching, and not just the Dharma. But in the Dharma teaching, all this is expressed in one word called samaditi. And samaditi is the view of life. And the view of life means a view of life which is not greed, not hate, and not delusion. And so I want to talk a little bit about this view of life, and then relate it a little bit to the social change. This view of life is fundamentally a holistic view. It's a view where everything is interacting with everything else. Where we begin to peel off the delusion that I am closed and wrapped inside myself and just spend my whole life from birth to death needing things. Instead of that, the view says, you're not alone. We are not isolated selves. We are in constant interaction with everything else. That we belong to the land as much as anything belongs to anything. Thich Nhat Hanh calls it interbeing, using the word interbeing. It's a nice word in English. I guess he really created that word. And it means all things being with all other things. All beings being with all other beings. And it's a quality or a sort of understanding, an awakening that if we look at our life, we see our life as a kind of a web, as a kind of like there's an image of Indra, the net of Indra in the coming from the Hindu tradition, which is the nature of the world, which is like the physics of ancient India. And the Indra's net is a net. At each crossing point is a jewel, and the jewels are reflecting each other crossing point. Right? So each crossing point is reflecting all other crossing points. Yeah. Something like that. So that, and that's the nature of reality. Of matter, of substance, of all beings, that we're in a web, and that we're in a web of interrelationship with everything else. And the boundaries between things, such as the boundary between my body and the world, are part of delusion. And if we look carefully, we don't actually find them. Very difficult to say where the boundaries really are. And in everything changing and everything passing through and everything, our thoughts passing through, where is the boundaries? With our lives passing through and our bodies passing, getting, you know, dying off and new bodies coming, and where are the boundaries? Where is the world that is chopped into pieces, objects, selves, things, ownership? Where is it? So this view is basically a holistic view. Holistic meaning whole, encompassing. And in this view, everything becomes significant. And that's a very important thing to understand. In this view, everything becomes significant or meaningful. Because within ourselves, we tend to have a priority. And the priority is number one, first. Number two, maybe my family, my children. Number three, my group. Number four, my country. Number five, my football team. Whatever. We have what's meaningful to me, we have a priority centered around self. As we can explore it, we can sort of get over those boundaries and feel our interaction. Yes, we have close relationship with our family, close relationship with our children, close relationship with our friends. But then our relationships continue. It's not just that they stop there in the boundaries, that they continue out, that we feel ourselves in a web of interaction, in the street, in the life, in the animals, in the plants, and we notice more. We notice the flowers that otherwise we wouldn't notice. We notice the children that otherwise we wouldn't notice. We notice the needs of people that otherwise we wouldn't notice. We notice the web of influence on us and influence on what we do to others, which otherwise we wouldn't notice. So this waking up is about noticing a much wider web of interaction between us and the world. That's what the waking up is. Noticing. Being. Giving meaning. One meditation teacher was asked, why do you meditate? Why meditate? And he said, yeah, it's very... Munindra, he was called. Oh, it's very clear to me why I meditate. So I pay attention to the small little flowers that are on the side of the path as I walk to my house, which otherwise I wouldn't see.
Children usually see it.
And the meaning then, meaning of things, mashmud, is not in concept, which is so much a Western thing. What's the meaning of life? What's the meaning of life? So, needs university, needs lots of books, it needs lots of thinking, it needs lots of philosophers, and in the end you're just in a circle, round and round and round and round and round and round and round, and then you go off and maybe start again another life and so on. What's the meaning of this one? The meaning of life is not in concept. The meaning of life is directly felt. And that's right view. It's directly felt or directly experienced at a level below thinking about. It's not thinking about things. It's the meaning is directly felt and experienced. And in this connect, in this understanding of being in a web, being interconnected, in a natural way, what we were talking about yesterday, comes love and comes attention. Attention is a form of love. If we notice things, there is interconnection. If our web is, let it stop here, it's the basis for all motivation to change society. That is the motivation to heal society. That's what it is. It's feeling connected, and it doesn't matter what part of society we're talking about or what part of the world. It doesn't matter. It can be this tree, or it can be this person, or it can be, I'm not going to let people die in hospital, I'm going to go and visit them. I'm not going to let people die alone. That's going to be my mission. The mission can be making compost. It doesn't matter. It's where you happen to be touched at that moment in your life. You happen to be touched by something that's meaningful to you, and because your vision is right view, is a holistic, interacting vision, you say, I'm here for this. I'm here for you. I'm here for this need. Or I'm here. I'm in interaction. I'm responding. I was talking to Edna yesterday. Edna said, well, isn't this this kind of interaction, this way of interacting, doesn't it make you feel very responsible? You have to kind of take the burden of the world on your shoulders. And I said, answered to her, look at the English word responsibility. Responsibility. It just means the ability to respond. It doesn't mean you have to take on your shoulders the burden of healing the whole universe. But it means an ability to respond. An ability just to be there. Because if you have the holistic vision, you're just there, and things will, you'll answer the call of yourself, of others, as it comes. So to get to the personal bit, don't quite know where to start. It all seems like one long dream. Actually, someone else's dream. But I do want to go back to perhaps some of my own personal roots in motivation, and a lot of it came from, first of all, my childhood. And my childhood in England was of a very questioning, very internalized young boy. growing up in suburbs, and questioning, what is going on here? Why do things have to be like that? Very rebellious, but very internal. And then the 60s for me was a very important breakthrough, and I was very much at the beginning of the 60s revolution. I happened to arrive in California in 1967 as an innocent guy from the suburbs of London, and there I was in this unbelievable explosion of vision. And I think vision in the 60s was a vision of a new society as much as an internal vision, which is a vision of LSD, how LSD changed the world for you. And it was very strong for me, very, very strong. Seeing suddenly, it was like my world was smashed to pieces. And I believe Timothy Leary is a great prophet. And turn on, tune in, drop out. And that was like a fantastic thing to discover. And I arrived at the time when LSD was completely legal. It wasn't illegal. It was a sacred act. It was interesting. It was a sacred act to turn on. It's interesting. And but it gave, I think, us at that time in the 60s, it was a very radical, very, very radical break from all levels. The family, the world of wars, the society of greed, the society that said creativity was Beethoven. And so many levels of social consensus, the 60s, at least to me, broke it. And from then, actually at that point, I understood, because of the LSD experience, that the inside, inner change and outer change go together. That the outer change has to come from seeing the world differently. That it cannot just be from doing good, because one ought to do good. It has to come from seeing the world differently. And at that time, that was the vision of the 60s, was a holistic vision. It was seeing the world differently, where every tree talked to you. It's a real touch of things. You talk to the trees talk to you. So now you look back on the 60s and think, well, these crazy guys, flower power and all that stuff, but actually living inside it as 18 years old guy, it was incredibly powerful. The trees were talking to you. You really experienced the trees talking to you and you talking to the trees. You really experienced it. That what was a tree was a blaze of color and shape and change and living energies. So, I mean, that's strong stuff. Going a little bit towards lots of creative changes. I was involved in lots of things, and I kept kind of connected to society. I got a PhD, I became a scientist, but within me was all the time this vision that was really from childhood, before the time of the 60s, a vision of a vital power or a vital energy that gave life to everything. That it wasn't that we had to look for spirit, it was that spirit made us. That our bodies were made out of this. That was something very deep, the kind of vital force view that I had all this period. It's a view. And I had all this period. So I was trying to work with that and science, which was a big issue. And I had problems with university. I was teaching University of London in 76 and 77. And I had big fights because of the scientists I was working with. And in the end, I decided that I had to leave university, and I still work with science, but trying to use science to make a bridge between science and the spirit. And so all the years of the 70s and 80s, in a way, I was doing that, especially in the world of holistic health. Okay, so, but I saw, I mean, even holistic health. So we have a choice here to see holistic health as techniques, as acupuncture, as diet and so on, or to make it something which is a holistic vision of me in the world and healing coming from the relationship between me and the world, between right view, not just as technique. Acupuncture is safer than drugs. So for me, the holistic health was part of this. India a couple of years, and then I came to Israel, and we started to form a new community, which is CLIL. And interesting lesson of CLIL is that CLIL is in many ways a total failure. And the failure is because the people who started CLIL as an alternative, it's an alternative village, I still live there, it's in the Galilee. When we started CLIL, we started with a radical vision of ecology. And it was mamash radical. Personally, we lived 5 years without a toilet, just like what you have here, we had for 5 years with 3 children. We didn't want a toilet. We didn't need a toilet. We had a compost toilet in the bushes. That was enough. We had 3 children. We had no telephone. We had no electricity. Nothing. And the whole village, small village, was the same. And we were very extreme. We had a principle that, for example, we're not allowed to build our houses using electricity. So everything had to be done by hand.
When was it?
In the beginning of the 80s. Everything we did by hand. And it was a principle that we held on to. We had to build our house by hand. Sawing the wood, carrying the stones, not using machines, building. I spent years building. and very important time for me, though. I think time of something, some purification, something important in that. In a sense, it was a spiritual thing for me too, but not just sitting, but actually stones, talking the language of stones, feeling the stones, letting the stones talk to me, slowly building, creatively building a house, was a big teaching for me. And losing all the staff, forgetting, you know, PhD, forgetting all of that staff. But the failure in CLIL was that we never built a sense of Sangha. We never built mechanisms of dialogue between us. We never went to learn how to go through processes between us. And ecology was a principle, was a kind of a view, was a thing that had to be done. And there was no spirituality in the community. The community was like, the view or the ideology was instead of everything else. And here I think it's a very good example in my own life of how it's so important, just what we were saying before, that maybe this example can help you to catch this thing of the inner and the outer have to be together. So in Kriya at the beginning, there was only the outer. There was no inner. Every single dialogue between the people in Kriya was about, shall we use a tractor or not? Shall we cut the stone? Shall we cut a stone, or is it a bad thing to do? Shall we, you know? And gradually, the argument started, the fights between people, the sense of ownership, my land, my this, my way, my ideology, I'm the better ecologist than you, I do things right and you do things wrong, they over there, they're not, then, you know, they've got a nadlanut mind, those people there, they don't, you know, etc., etc., all the old stuff coming up because it was all outer. And it's exactly what you see today. If things are only on the outer level, then there's always a limit. Arguments will begin, anger will be there. It doesn't matter whether it's a political group for change to make peace or it's a social group. If you don't pay attention to the inner as well, then all the stuff comes up and creates machsonim and pain and difficulty. And we experienced it until today in Kriya. Nevertheless, I must say, as a postscript, as a kind of today, Kriya, I think, is a beautiful place, and I'm really happy to be there. And mostly because of the new people who are coming and appreciate that, after all, there was something very special done there. It was a special beginning. This sense of ecology was important, and so a lot of people are coming and making this place transformed, and it's getting better and better. And a lot of this inner work is there today that never was at the beginning, and it's making the place, you know, a totally different place. So I must say, it's sort of, I hope it's going up. Yes, there's just the people are more conscious. There's more dialogue on the level of self, on the level of understanding, and there's meditation and yoga and different forms of Tai Chi and all sorts of things going on. It's not only that, though. It's the importance given to inner life, which can go in many different directions. It's not just how many Tai Chi and yoga groups there are. It's more than that. It's at what level is the social dialogue? Or what level is a personal dialogue? And where are people putting their importance? Is it just on ideology, or is it also on the personal growth of the consciousness? And it can take many languages, this personal growth. It can take many languages. But it's there. It's the interest, really, in freedom, in waking up. Basically, it's the interest. Is there interest in waking up? Put it like that. And that interest is growing now, and it wasn't there before. In the last few years, and this is something we're going to talk about tomorrow and the next day, so I'm not going to go into it, but in the last few years, I've been involved in projects and organizations to do with peacemaking, trying to embody the vision of inner and outer, that outer peacemaking needs inner peacemaking too. And that has created the dialogues we did in Nablus for many years, called the Transformation of Suffering. It's an interesting title. The name of the dialogue workshops, the Transformation of Suffering, meaning using the acknowledgement of pain means also waking up to the existence of difficulty, and using it as a kind of vehicle for change. So, and it's possible with ordinary people. In other words, it doesn't need everybody involved in all of this to be Buddhas. Going to the Palestinian territories, talking in deep dialogue with Palestinians about their life, about their pains, about their difficulties, sharing difficulties, There's nothing that makes people closer than sharing difficulties, than sharing their personal life. There's nothing that makes it happen quickly. And when someone is deeply listening to you about your pain in your life, and you're deeply listening to somebody else, their pain in their life, that's the end of enemy. That's the end. You cannot, after that, see that person as the other, the enemy, the them over there. And it works both ways. It doesn't matter whether it's Palestinian and an Israeli soldier talking together. So we embodied this teaching in peace work. And it's still happening in Shvil Zahav and Akodo, and we'll talk to you about these things later. But these movements, at least for me, have been incredibly important in showing a way in which inner change and social change are one and the same thing. And in a few words, there's a lot more, but that'll do for the moment.